to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with our co-host, Pat Schlarbaum. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Susan, and hi to you, our valued listeners. Today's show will feature the work to address drastic declines in the population of monarch butterflies in North America. We will be listening to Dr. Stephen Bradbury, who was the Midwest Director for the Environmental Protection Agency for 15 years in Duluth, Minnesota, and then went to Washington, D.C. for additional contributions to the EPA, and that's the Environmental Protection Agency. Dr. Bradbury has retired from the EPA and is currently on staff at Iowa State University and a member of the Iowa Monarch Consortium. Then later in the show, we will learn about monarch work with Jesse Lowry, who is conservation coordinator with the Blank Park Zoo. Yes, conservation efforts at modern zoos goes way beyond having animal specimens in cages. So that's our show, Susan, but first it's membership time at KHOI.
We are fundraising to sustain our mission of building community through communication. Please be included in our expanding community of supporters and volunteers to this work. It is work, but it is also much more to be included in something positive that can benefit all Iowans with your sustaining support. For a wide expanse of station topics from local foods, local music, local political issues, any topic that addresses community needs are not too great for our KHOI reporters and producers. And our national and international stories are the best in the state. I think we're not supposed to say best.
Oh, I'm speaking from the heart. Pardon that edit, Susan.
Please consider this opportunity to financially support KHOI station work. Please call 515-292-2878 or contribute online at khoifm.org. That's 515-292-2878 or online at khoifm.org. And incidentally, about that best, that was an opinion, and you have your own opinions, and that's one of the wonderful things about KHOI. We have a broad variety of opinions.
And I'm allowed to be a rookie. And
those things right, and you're allowed to have rookie
as long
opinions
as I apologize
on the air.
Yeah, okay. But listeners, please consider our basic membership of $55 per year or whatever value that works for your budget. Please realize becoming one of our sustaining members is the best investment money can buy to strengthen the Ames community through communication. Our communication, it's your communication with facilities at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames. Stop in for a visit at the Ames Pantorium building. We welcome you to our growing community of supporters. So let's start our morning local talk with a phonology from Doug Haar, director of Iowa Audubon. Good morning, Doug.
Morning, Pat.
Well, how's everything at your darkened deck in Ogden?
Well, I'm not seeing too many birds out in the yard yet this morning.
They'll be coming, though, and that's kind of our theme.
That's right.
We're going to talk about butterflies, specifically monarch butterflies, but let's talk about some of these other arrivals. The monarchs are departing, but let's have – what's your take on seeing any red-breasted nuthatches?
I personally haven't, but they are being reported now around the state, and last year there was virtually none in Iowa. These are little birds that come down primarily from the Northwoods up northern Minnesota and Canada, Wisconsin, and they're starting to show up around the state. And that species, along with several other birds that are now being reported across the state, are pretty well an indicator that we might have a pretty good winter for some birds that we don't see here that all that often or that many of.
Well, and are you referring to red poles or what?
Yes, that's another one. The red poles, now I used to work up in northern Iowa, and we saw them fairly frequently in the winter in the Spirit Lake area, but to see them in other places in Iowa, southern Iowa, eastern Iowa, western Iowa, is a little more unusual, and they're already turning up at several people's feeders and the edges of woodlands and weedy fields and stuff around the state. We're seeing quite a few reports of those already, and those are Arctic nesting birds.
And where could our listeners tune into those reports, Doug?
There, you can go on the Iowa Ornithologist Union's website, and you can subscribe for free to something called the Iowa Bird Listserv. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see those reports being turned in by bird watchers from across the state, where they're being seen. And if you're really interested in seeing some of these rare things, that would give you an opportunity to go maybe see if they could try to find them.
We haven't received any major Arctic blasts, but are people going to be anticipating? I think there's been a couple snowy owls already.
There have been, at least a couple of snowy owls seen this winter. That's a good indicator that this might be a fairly big winter for snowy owls again. And then another one I've been seeing quite a few of. In fact, I may have seen about as many as anybody in the state so far, and that's rough-legged hawks. They are an Arctic ground-nesting hawk, and I've seen 8 of them in the past month already, including 3 on Monday.
So, now, how do you differentiate between a rough-legged hawk and a red-tailed hawk, our local red-tailed hawks?
Well, they can be a little bit difficult, especially the females tend to maybe look a little bit like a red-tailed hawk, but for one thing, they don't have a red tail. They've got a banded tail. They've got a black belly. The males, it's a very black underside, and the females, it can be kind of a mottled black underside. And then a kind of a creamy colored head. And so some people actually mistake them for, at a distance, for maybe having seen a bald eagle, but they're not. They're the size of a red-tailed hawk, and this looks like it might be a pretty good winter to see them. And I frequently see them every winter on the west edge of Ames along Highway 30. I think one bird there in particular probably returns that same wintering site every year.
Well, I have a question. With all of these Arctic birds coming down, is this kind of a weather prediction? Do they know something that we don't know about what kind of winter we're going to have?
Well, that's possible, but it's rather unlikely. More than anything else, when we get an invasion of more Arctic species, it tends to be related to their food supply up north. So if their food supply is short, especially for the seed-eating birds like redpolls and things like that, they're just coming down to where they can find a bigger weed or seed supply. Now, things like snowy owls, in recent years, their population seems to have boomed a little bit in the Arctic, and what we see mostly is young owls coming down because there just isn't enough. There aren't enough lemmings and mice and things that they eat up there to keep the whole population going. So the young owls move out, and they tend to come down into the United States and hunt mice and things down here.
Is there climate change woven into the snowy owl number? We used to have these, well, let's use a term, an eruption. And red-breasted nuthatches and snowy owls. Mm-hmm. We'd go 3 or 4 years like in a cycle. But it seems like in recent times, it's the snowy owls are here about every winter now.
Yeah, the cycles are definitely increasing for things like snowy owls. Now, whether that's related to climate change or not, that's really difficult to say. I mean, there are certain birds that nest here in Iowa during the summer and are moving further and further north each year. That's probably a little bit more signal of climate change than what's going on with the Arctic birds that come down here for the winter. But that still needs a lot of investigation by scientists.
Well, I have another question. Since they eat mice, and I currently moved out to the country for a brief time, and I'm discovering mice. And I talk to my neighbors, and they say, "Oh, yes, that's what you have out in the country. Then mice coming into your house by, well, it seems like the dozens." Will I get to see any rough-legged hawks or any predators in my yard?
Well, it's entirely possible. I mean, if there's a good population of mice running around the yard, some hawks are going to find that. It might be local red tails, or it could be some of those rough legs from the Arctic as well. So it's hard to tell. You just have to keep watching out your windows.
Well, it's a different kind of bird feeder.
Yes.
Doug Haar, director of Iowa Audubon, thank you so much for calling in and helping us with our membership drive these days. And keep looking up.
Okay. Enjoyed visiting with you.
Thank you. So maintaining our outdoor theme, let's focus upon butterflies, specifically the monarch butterflies. In 1995, population estimates approached 1 billion. That would be included in considerable range here of the Midwest. And in this 20-year time frame, their numbers have dwindled to what they're estimating at about 38 million last year, and that is a decline of 97%. Clearly, this is a population trend that borders on catastrophic, and if it continues, this species might possibly be in peril of extinction in our lifetime, Susan. Recently, I was able to sit down with Dr. Stephen Bradbury at Iowa State University and discuss his role with a group of scientists and government agencies, individuals that have formed a monarch consortium to deal with the plight of the monarchs. Welcome to Local Talk, Dr. Stephen Bradbury. Are you from the Ames area?
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, in Madison, Milwaukee, and after my undergraduate at University of Wisconsin, I came out to Iowa State for my graduate work, got my master's and PhD here from 1979 through 1985.
Are you an entomologist?
Well, I have a double major in my PhD, entomology and toxicology.
Did you have a career in other agencies?
So after I got my PhD at Iowa State, I went up north on I-35 up to Duluth, Minnesota, and joined the Environmental Protection Agency and spent about 15 years up in Duluth. In the last several years, I was the director of that laboratory. And that laboratory takes a look at water quality issues and other aspects of toxicology. And then around 2002, 2003, I went out to Washington, D.C., still an EPA, and for the last 4 or 5 years I was out there, I was the director of EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs and retired from EPA and then came out to Iowa State and now a faculty member in entomology and natural resource ecology and management.
Well, in some regards, welcome home.
Right, it's kind of a circle of life. Uh-huh. But during my time in EPA, I spent a lot of time doing collaborative work with folks here at Iowa State on a variety of issues over the years.
And you're currently heading up what we're referring to as the Monarch Consortium?
Well, yeah, myself and other colleagues here at Iowa State, as well as colleagues in Iowa Department of Natural Resources and Iowa Department of Agricultural and Land Stewardship. Together, we have a group of folks that are helping a broader coalition of organizations in Iowa, agriculture, conservation organizations that have as their focus what we can do in Iowa to help with creating a sustainable population of monarch butterflies, both in Iowa and the country and North America as a whole.
Their population in drastic decline?
Yeah, over the last several years, the populations have gone down. One of the easiest ways to try to track monarch populations is looking at how many monarchs are in Mexico in the winter.
Were they overwintering?
Were they overwinter, right. So the monarch species during the course of a year goes through 4 to 5 generations. And about this time, we're in early November, so the last generation that was living in Iowa headed south about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and those butterflies are arriving in Mexico about now or in the next couple of weeks.
And how many miles is that from Iowa?
I'll have to get out my Google map. I don't remember offhand, but it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles.
I think it's close to 1,000.
Probably close to 1,000, yeah. And so they'll be spending the winter down in Mexico in some forests not too far from Mexico City. And they all congregate in these big trees. And that's a very convenient way to keep track of how many monarchs there are in North America, and folks can go down there and estimate how many hectares are occupied by
hectares
monarchs.
Are like 2.5 acres,
right,
I guess,
right,
in Iowa.
Right, right. Yep.
So they can kind of they look at how many hectares and can extrapolate from that
right.
what the population
right.
is.
And so over the years, going back to the early 1990s till about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the amount of hectares occupied by the monarchs bounced around a bit, but generally around 6 hectares or so was sort of the typical surface area covered by the monarchs. And then over the last, about 2 or 3 years, the numbers have really gone down. And so over the last year or two, maybe about 1 hectare has been occupied by monarchs. And so that got a lot of attention from conservationists as well as the governments of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And a couple of years ago, there was an agreement among the 3 countries that we would need to work together to try to do what can be done in Mexico with the overwintering habitat and what can be done in the U.S. and Canada in terms of the breeding habitat for the monarch to try to help get those numbers back up.
What can we do, Dr. Bradbury?
So in our part of the world, and the monarch's world, one of the things that we can do is help to increase the amount of monarch breeding habitat in Iowa and other neighboring states in the upper Midwest. One of the limiting factors in turning around the population numbers is the limited amount of habitat for the monarchs to breed. And so that's one of the major areas of emphasis that the consortium is looking at.
And what are the components of a monarch habitat?
So the monarch relies exclusively on milkweed species, and there's in Iowa, I think there's about 9 species of milkweed that are in Iowa, but the monarch needs to lay its eggs on a monarch plant, and once the egg hatches, the caterpillars get their nutrition by eating the leaves of a milkweed plant, and that's the only plant that they'll lay eggs on. It's the only plant that caterpillars can grow on. And so that's a critical species. But also the adult monarch needs flowers, needs plants that are blooming.
Oh, the nectar sources.
And that's how they get their nectar, and so get their sugar and other nutrients that they need. So the adult needs, the adult will use the flowers from the monarch, or from the milkweed, but also a whole variety of other kinds of flowering plants. So the adult needs flowering plants to get nectar, sugar. But the caterpillar only will live on monarch plants.
Their habitat is under duress. We don't seem to be planting enough prairie. But what are some of the other causes of this habitat decline?
The breeding habitat decline is due to a number of factors. Some of it's land development. Cities are growing, suburbia is growing, and that uses up land that used to have some of this kind of habitat. In weed management over the years, as part of farmers' need to reduce weeds in their fields, which is really important for controlling resistance development in herbicides and weed management, just the amount of milkweed that used to live in corn and soybean fields has gone down. Lots of farmers talk about when they were growing up and remembering walking the fields and chopping milkweed in between the rows of corn and soybean. Well, that doesn't happen very often anymore based on some of the techniques used to try to manage weeds in production fields. So between urban development, suburban development, different kinds of weed management approaches over the years, the amount of milkweed in the environment has gone down. So the goal is how to take a look at underutilized areas in agriculture and other locations in cities and suburban parks to try to increase the amount of habitat.
And underutilized agricultural areas, where are we at here? Just the odd corners?
Yeah, there could be odd corners where equipment doesn't fit in and so there isn't crops growing. It could be, one of the areas we're looking at, it could also be areas that are being used for other conservation practices. For example, Iowa farmers are beginning to implement nutrient reduction strategy technology like saturated buffers or bioreactors or wetlands, and we're taking a look at how that footprint could also have on top of that footprint monarch breeding habitat. For the same investment, get 2 or 3 ecological goods and services out of areas in a farm that aren't devoted to corn.
Yeah, I think the listeners can appreciate terracing and waterways and just waterway management, but essentially creating some monarch butterfly habitat in the sowing of milkweed plants.
Right, and these other flowering plants that we've talked about. We're not proposing to put milkweed back into the corn and soybean fields, but take advantage of other areas outside the fields to expand the habitat.
Yeah, real good point, yeah.
With intensive agriculture, like the kind of agriculture in the Midwest. So one of the things we're going to be working through is where are those underutilized areas in a farm to get these habitat patches going? And then we'll be working through best management practices in terms of the pest management that has to happen on corn and soybean fields, for example, and realizing that those fields may be close to where some of the habitat's going in. So we'll be working with lots of folks on sort of how to optimize pest management, minimize exposure to the habitat as it starts to go into the landscape.
Are we going to be able to avoid the monarch butterflies becoming endangered?
When was it? Maybe about a year or so ago. There was a petition by some folks to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service asking the Fish and Wildlife Service to consider listing the monarch butterfly as a threatened species.
And they are the regulatory agency.
Right,
that
the U.S.
Right. Purview over
yeah,
that.
Right. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has responsibility, at least for animals that live on land, so to speak, or inland waters, to implement the Endangered Species Act. So they're in the process now of evaluating whether or not the information about population trends of the monarch and other issues they have to look at are of such a nature that they may have to list the species as a threatened species. But that decision is probably several years out before they'll make that decision as they analyze all the information that's around there. So it's possible that it could be listed. The focus right now in the consortium and with a lot of other folks is, while cognizant of that issue and should stay aware of that issue, our goal right now is conservation of the species. If we're successful in developing and launching a conservation program in Iowa and neighboring states in the upper Midwest, and our state colleagues down in Texas and Oklahoma and Kansas, where the spring generation comes up, if those efforts are successful, there would be no need to list the species. And so we're really looking at how to develop and implement voluntary conservation programs among farmers, ranchers, urban residents, suburban residents, and how together can we get the conservation practices in play, and then we don't really need to be worried about the Endangered Species Act.
What role can Iowa best play in this opportunity to avoid the Endangered Species Act?
And more importantly, to help with the monarch populations becoming stable, and that's our primary goal.
Right.
Not having to list through the ESA will be
It's huge.
It's huge. It'll be a good outcome, but that outcome will be reached because of the conservation efforts that we're undertaking. In the state of Iowa, we've got a really good effort underway. The consortium, I think, reflects how many organizations in Iowa come together and work on issues of common interest and come up with innovative solutions. And so the partnerships with the university, IDNR, IDELS, and the different grower livestock producer organization, conservation organizations in Iowa, I think, are reflective of how people are coming together and coming together to figure out what kind of science needs to be done, what kinds of demonstration projects are needed, moving into outreach and extension as we move into implementation. And a number of the states around us have been in discussion, either neighboring universities or other state organizations are in discussion. And not that what we do in Iowa is a cookie cutter for every state around us, but I think we help serve as an example of how to bring organizations together, how to be thinking through a plan and executing a plan that we're sharing with our neighboring states and neighboring land-grant universities. Again, it's not one size fits all. You have to adapt for your state and your cropping production systems and other landscape features, but there's some common threads. So we don't have to all reinvent the wheel. And then working together across the states in the upper Midwest and with the states down south, collectively get on the path to what needs to be done for the conservation of the species.
Well, I think here in Iowa, we're fortunate to have individuals like yourself that have dedicated your careers to the conservation that has been shown that benefits everybody in our society. You've come back to Iowa State, and you're heading up a very significant, important group that our listeners can express our gratitude to you for that. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners?
I think just to say that it's a group effort. It's a team effort across the state. And so it's a challenging issue, but it's an issue that I think can be addressed, and by all these different organizations working together, we can make a big difference. And I think I was in a leadership role to help share what we're learning and approaches that can be used to do this, that we can deal with this conservation issue and biodiversity and maintain agricultural productivity so we can grow monarchs and we can grow corn and soybeans and we can do both, and we can grow our hogs and grow and maintain our cattle production and maintain and enhance monarch populations. And I think that's a great opportunity for the state of Iowa and our neighbors.
Let's not leave out the monarchs. Some of these critters are just kind of priceless.
Yeah, and it's as you talk to folks, you know, everybody remembers, you know, the monarchs growing up, if they're our age, right? And so it is a vision or an image that gets people to talk and think about some of these approaches and options and how to move forward.
We've been listening to Dr. Stephen Bradbury, who is a spokesperson of the Monarch Consortium here in Iowa, hoping to bring back the monarchs. So you're listening to Local Talk, 89.1 FM, Story City Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We are currently fundraising to sustain our mission of building community through communication. Please be included in our expanding community of supporters and volunteers to this work.
Well, for you, KHOI, as well as Monarch Butterflies, is your renewable resource. And that can mean a couple of things for you. It's a resource that keeps coming back to you each and every day. But it also needs something to feed on. We need to pay our electricity so that we can send out our signals and have our studio operating. And we need to pay our rent. Mm-hmm. There was a delightful program earlier this year with our landlord who likes us because we like him because he's a great landlord, and he likes us because we pay our rent.
And we need financial assistance.
That's right.
Keep the lights on here.
That's right. Like all renewable resources, KHOI is there for you every day, 365 days a year, and that's what we do, 24/7, 365 days a year, powering you through your day with great music and local and international news. And stories about important things in your environment, like monarch butterflies and like your neighbors. And like all resources, community radio is part of our shared heritage. Community radio belongs to us, to the people. It's our right, created by Congress, to have a public radio system. And like all rights, it comes with responsibilities. So please pick up the phone right now and call us at 515-292-2878 and tell the volunteer who answers the phone, I want to protect my natural resource. I want to become a member of KHOI. I've been thinking about this for days, and the time has come for me to do my part.
Yeah, please pick up your phone and call 515-292-2878. Or go online to khoifm.org. It's just a great opportunity to consider our basic membership of $55 per year or whatever value that works for your budget. Please realize becoming one of our sustaining members is the best investment money can buy to strengthen the Ames community through communication. It's our communication, your communication. We need your financial support. So pick up the phone, 515-292-2878. And now, back to the program. I'd like to introduce Jesse Lowry. Jesse is the conservation manager for the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. They do tremendous work, and let's listen to what their campaign is to assist people in Central Iowa to bring back the monarchs.
Well, Jesse Lowry, welcome to Local Talk. And your position here at the Blank Park Zoo is?
I'm conservation manager.
And how many years have you been involved at that level?
I've been here for 10 years, and most of the time here at Blank Park Zoo has been spent being a zookeeper. I've taken care of a diverse array of animals, from birds to invertebrates to sea lions to snakes.
Oh, sure.
And throughout those years, zookeeping most of my time and then doing conservation work on the side, and then maybe a day per week and then a couple days per week. And then finally this year, the zoo as an organization took the very important step to make the new role full-time conservation manager.
So you're the first?
I am the first.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's part of our initiative to make saving animals in the wild just more part of our mission and part of what we do here as a role of a modern zoo.
And a modern zoo, you know, for a lot of the listeners, they may think animals in cages. But it goes way beyond that.
You know, if you look back at what zoos used to be, often menageries of a single person's collection of wild animals. What zoos really are today, what I like to say, is a window to the wild. We want to provide a recreational, educational space for you and your family to come and see these beautiful, charismatic species. Look into the eyes of a snow leopard, see the agility of a sea lion. Many people won't have the opportunity to go to Africa or Asia and see these animals in the wild, and unfortunately they're disappearing at alarming rates. Mm-hmm. And we want them to feel that sense of awe that you feel when you see these animals and be inspired to then take care of them in the wild.
It's a window to the wild.
It's a window to the wild. And, you know, if you think about that, it's sometimes that's quite a leap to have that feeling of awe when you see an animal in a zoo, mm-hmm. to then be inspired to take care of them in the wild. Uh-huh. So as conservation manager, that's my job, to make sure that the public coming mm-hmm. through our gates, you know, hears those conservation messages mm-hmm. and walks out of our gate with concrete conservation actions that they can do to help save our environment and save these declining mm-hmm. animal populations. Plant, Grow, Fly, our pollinator conservation project, is one way that we're doing that.
And that is a new program for the conservation outreach?
It sure is. We hosted an international conservation conference in 2013 called the Zoos and Aquariums Committing to Conservation Conference, where we had representatives from 18 different countries come here in Des Moines. Half were field people, half were zoo people, and we sat down for a week and talked about how we could deepen partnerships. We met with all the other Midwestern zoos and said, okay, we're all doing these wonderful things for conservation, but what kind of regional specific environmental issue can we collaborate on? And pollinator conservation rose to the top. So in 2013, we came back to Blank Park and started talking about what kind of program we could design. And monarch conservation really rose to the top at first, but when we started delving deeper into the issues, we soon found out that not just the monarch butterfly, but many other native pollinators and many other, native bees needed our help.
Right.
So we designed Plant, Grow, Fly to really move the masses, to incite a conservation action with the general public, whether it's a 5-year-old or a 95-year-old, to give them a concrete mm-hmm. conservation action that they could do by planting butterfly gardens, by getting hands back in Iowa soil. Something that everybody can do. Have seed packets that we sell at the zoo, all native plants to Iowa. Mm-hmm. We also have talked to lots of local nurseries here in Iowa, asked them if they were concerned about declining pollinators, if they want to be part of our projects, and if they would decline to putting chemicals on their butterfly plants. And if they said yes to all those things, then we included them in our project.
What are some of the key species of plants that pollinators are seeking?
Well, to be an official plant, grow, fly garden, you have to include in your garden at least one host plant off of our list and at least one nectar plant off of our list. So we'll back up here just for a moment to explain what those are. Uh-huh. A host plant is the plant that butterflies lay their eggs on and the plant their caterpillars eat. So, for example, the monarch's host plant is milkweed. Mm-hmm. The nectar plant, of course, is food for butterflies. They eat the nectar. So to be an official plant grow fly garden, you need at least one host plant and at least one nectar plant. We have some literature, and of course we have all this information is on our website at blankparkzoo.com. You can also just Google plant grow fly. And we worked with our many partners. We have over 50 local, national, and regional partners. But many of the partners that helped us create our plant list were Ryman Gardens at Iowa State University. We worked with Iowa Prairie Network, the Native Plant Society, to come up with what we call our plant recipe. And for instance, some of our host plants are pussy toes, asters, false indigo, lupine, milkweed, native grasses, violets, sunflowers, black-eyed Susans, and so on. Mm-hmm. And some of our nectar plants that we suggest are bee balm, blazing star, coneflowers, cosmos, goldenrods, lantana, Joe Pieweed, and ironweed. And, you know, lots of different factors came into play when we created our garden recipe. We want to make sure that novice gardeners are successful, that they can find the plants at local greenhouses, and that pollinators find the resources that they need. We also provide all of the information on our website on how to plant the garden. For instance, something that I learned when we started researching this project is that butterflies have to learn how to drink out of every flower. So it's great to clump one species of flower. So don't just plant one plug of asters and one plug of pussy toes right beside each other. Mm-hmm. Plant an entire clump of pussy toes, because your butterfly will then go down and spend an entire afternoon drinking out of all of the pussy toes and will get all of the energy they need. But if you have all these different species of flowers closely next to each other, it'll have to learn how to get the nectar out of each individual different species of flower. And then, you know, it'll only get, you know, some of the energy, and then it'll have to learn how to get the food out of the next flower. So I thought that was very interesting.
There's a matter of efficiency.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we wanted to make sure that we made it very easy for people. And then the really interesting and neat part about this project is after you plant your garden, you can register on the zoo's website, and we recognize you on the website. We post information about your garden. We have a map of all the gardens. To date, we have 512 registered gardens with the project. Some are as small as pots on the back porch. Some are entire prairie fields. We have them throughout the state of Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Missouri. We even have gardens in California, Virginia, and Louisiana. And we have gardeners from 5-year-olds to 95-year-olds. And so we just wanted to make this an easy, concrete conservation action that when people came to the zoo and when they heard about this project, that instead of feeling overwhelmed and like these big pollinator issues, the decline of the monarch butterfly, the decline of our bees, that this is not something that you can't do anything about. No, you can. You can put habitat in your yard. And I think the gold standard in pollinator conservation is the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S. Uh-huh. And even they agree that a small pot on your back porch can be a gas station for pollinators. It's maybe not going to be enough resources for a butterfly to come and be able to spend its entire life and have all of the breeding resources that it needs, but it can be a way station where it can come, get a little food, get a little bit of a drink, and then be a gas station where it can find a little bit of some resources that it needs until it can find resources in the schoolyard garden, and then it can find its way to Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge, and then it can find its way to a bigger garden at Iowa State University, and so on. And so it's creating wildlife corridors, exactly like we do with the big charismatic megafauna in Africa. It's exactly the same concept.
Absolutely. So the wildlife corridor, this is how our refuge system for waterfowl has been established. So in a backyard sense, you're providing safe, secure refueling spots for people to connect with something that's going to be real important. Why are the butterflies important in our lives?
The butterflies are important in our lives, first of all, I think, because they're pollinators. And pollinators, you know, including butterflies and bees and beetles and wasps and hornets and even small mammals, are responsible for one-third of our global food supply.
Our global food supply.
One out of every three bites of food that you eat is pollinated, actually by insects. And if you're a meat eater, or if you like ice cream, or if you like to drink milk, then the two-thirds of your global food supply, you know, is pollinated by insects, because the other one-third is indirectly pollinated because cows eat alfalfa, and alfalfa is pollinated by insects. People don't realize how much of our daily lives depend on pollinators. But it's not just that. They're indicator species of the health of the entire ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it's not, shouldn't always be about humans. That it shouldn't always be about what we need. That we don't understand all of the services that they do for the entire ecosystem. All of those plants that maybe humans don't eat, well, they're plants for the entire rest of the animal kingdom. And they have a right to exist in their own right. And by the way, some of them are extremely beautiful, like the monarch butterfly. I've heard hundreds and hundreds of stories of people who have come up to me after talks and told me stories of, in their childhood, seeing hundreds and hundreds of monarch butterflies in their backyard as they're migrating through in September on their way to Mexico, and how saddened they are now that they don't see that many monarch butterflies before. And there's just something about that people are missing, and that people want their children to have that experience as well. It shouldn't just be about what benefit they provide to us. They provide a huge benefit to our economy as well. But we don't realize how much we need them, and we don't realize how much the rest of the animal kingdom needs them. And they're indicator species on the health of the environment. So they're extremely important to us.
Very well spoken.
Thank you.
Well, you're a few years in to your plant grow fly. Where does it go from here? In your heart, is it beginning to make a difference?
Well, what I want to do is make it a more connected network of these individual gardeners. We have 512 gardeners. I want to make them more connected through communications. We also have our Monarch Festival that we do every September. We're partnering with the Latino Heritage Festival. This year was our first year. We had a very successful festival with over 2,500 people here at the zoo. We celebrated the monarch's migration to Mexico with crafts and activities, puppet shows. We had a bug parade where kids dressed up as their favorite insect.
So listeners can look forward to that next September.
Yep, that'll be an annual event. So we want to keep getting those messages out. We want to keep registering more gardens. We want to make sure our main focus is to increase habitat. We want to just keep mobilizing the public. And I have a 1.5-year-old daughter, and so I have an intense interest in connecting children with nature. I want to just continue to provide hope to the younger generation that it's not too late, and that these problems that we're facing today can be fixed, and that sometimes it can be simple, that it can really be going out in your backyard and getting dirty and putting some plants in the ground, and that you don't have to get down and out about things that are happening in the world today, that you really can just go back and plant some flowers, and it's going to make a difference. I think that if we continue down that road, it's going to make a difference, and it's going to help people feel a little bit better and have a more positive outlook, and it's important for a zoo to play that role, and we're happy to be playing that role. We also have 50 partners, including many local partners, the Botanical Center, the Science Center, many county conservation boards, Ryman Gardens, as I mentioned, Drake University, DMAC. We want to continue being a player, the Iowa DNR, in local conservation, and continue to make a bigger impact in the local Iowa conservation. Because as a zoo, we've always been making a big impact with conservation of rhino and giraffe and lions. But we want to continue to be a player, and a bigger player, in local conservation as well. Just continue to grow. I want to really try to make that network of gardeners, no matter how big we get, feel like it's a small community and feel like they're all connected. So that's my goal.
Oh, Jesse Lowry, thank you so much for all you do for conservation.
Thank you so much. Funny, when we started this project, it was right before all the Monarch stuff blew up, like all the attention blew up, like 2013. It was all in the pipeline in 2013. It was all coming down the pipeline, but it was like, it wasn't all out in the media. And then so we started Plant Girl Fly, and then it was like right after we started Plant Girl Fly, it was like boom, then like the U.S. government all and everything, and everything started. And now it's so funny, it's almost like we kind of can't keep up with everything. And so just like we want, you know, we want to be included in all this stuff. And so, and you know, we're not the experts, and we're not trying to be the experts. And I know that, and just candidly, you know, I know that ours is just a tad bit fluffy, but we're happy to play that role of mobilizing the masses and mobilizing the families and the kids. We're working with Ryman Gardens, and you know, all of the plants are good, and we're make, and it's scientifically sound and all of that. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Oh, absolutely.
And so we want to be part of it, and
it's
even
your
though
niche.
We're, and even though it's our niche, and even though we're not the edgiest, and we're not going to be doing like all the research projects and stuff, mm-hmm. I think we still have a very important role to play.
Absolutely.
Because we're simple, and we're just like, you know what? Anybody can do this.
Yeah.
Anybody, if you have $10. Or, you know, I have a whole bunch of free seed packets, too. At all my talks, I just give them free seed packets. Mm-hmm. And so that I think that's an important niche to play, too.
We've been talking with Jesse Lowry, Conservation Outreach Coordinator for the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Did you learn anything, Susan?
Oh, I did. And it's one of the things maybe this is the time to say it. One of the things that I love about Local Talk, I love in producing it, is every time I do a show, I learn something. I learn something really interesting to me, and I hope it turns out to be interesting to our listeners. And when I go out with Paul Wearson, that's his standard. You know, if I learn something, it's
a good program.
It's a good program. But I'll tell you what I learned that was so exciting to me. I just sold my house that I've had for 50 years. And when I got there, there were some wild flocks. Semi-wild flocks. They were...
Are the blue...
No. Not that kind of wild flocks. No. I mean, these were... I think what it was, because they grew in the shade, they were garden flocks that had gotten adapted to my yard.
Sure.
And they were almost invasive. I mean, they would take over a garden. But the monarch butterflies love them. Okay. So back when there were hordes of monarch butterflies, they were all over these flocks. And I realized I had a butterfly way station and I didn't even know it.
they were a part of your family. So our membership drive, which is currently underway, is truly a family matter. Families share together. They share in love as well as sorrow. In good and bad times, families can make us crazy. But in the end, mostly they are what give us a richer meaning of life, like the butterflies. People who love KHOI and who listen are in a family too, whether they realize it or not. And like all family members, we support each other. We give and we take in with equal balance. So our task on the family to-do list is to bring you a great variety of music, local information every day. And we do that job to the very best of our ability. Your item on the list is to support your member-supported radio station that we can continue to bring you what we need. Community radio is different that way. Community radio belongs to us, to the people. It's our right, our inalienable right, created by Congress, to have a public radio system. And like all rights, it comes with responsibilities. So please pick up the phone right now. Give us a call at 515-292-2878 and tell the volunteer who answers the phone, I want to join the family. I want to become a member of KHOI. I've been thinking about it for days, and the time has come to do my part. I am all ready to take out a $55 membership. Or if you're needing to renew your membership, whatever value you place on this opportunity to connect with public radio, please consider becoming maybe one of our 500 Families Club of people who donate $250 or more to lay the sustaining foundation for KHOI. Please give us a call, 515-292-2878, or pledge securely online at our website, khoifm.org. www.iowastate.org.
And I'd just like to mention, in terms of being sustaining, that sustaining families membership, which we keep saying this week is $250 a year. Well, yeah, it is, but it's $20 or $21 a month. I think maybe they didn't like saying 20 because it only adds up to 240. But $20, $21 a month, you can support this station and keep it going. And I think we ought to be thinking about that easy sustainability. It's like my butterfly garden that I didn't even know I planted.
There it is. Yeah, that's something. And Susan, you have some updates for later today?
Yes. Well, this is one of the things I really like about Pledge Week. And I do. I enjoy it because every program is a live program. And so we have to really explore the different areas. We have a chance. This morning we have a chance to really go in depth in our nature programming, and we often have a phenology report from Pat Schlarbaum for 4 or 5 minutes on a regular program. But today the whole program is about nature, and we really had a chance to dig in and learn something. And at noon we're going to talk about the small towns that we serve in our usual
Local
talk
area. Yeah.
And well, actually, it just expanded to 10, and we'll talk about that this noon.
Learn more about that at noon. Okay.
That's right. And this evening we have a great music program with Marty Miller bringing in members of the original Barn Owl Band talking about how that developed.
How special is that?
That's right.
Yeah. Well,
You can listen to this show and all of our past local talk shows on our website, khoifm.org. Now, this is live, but you can listen to our shows online every day and explore it on that little black microphone. You'll find an archive on local talk shows that we have produced and since we went on the air in 2012 on our website. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. And this week, our really best live shows are up there, too, and it's really fun to see how the things you might have missed. And then you'll find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $21 per month or $25 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits your budget. We'd also like to hear feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email. And that's at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience and as contributor is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening.
See you again on the radio.